The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, there's we were discussing the relative importance of the Hadith and the Quran. There have been times when it began to seem as though the Hadith were more important than the Quran to many Muslims. There's a person who said that the Hadith could exist without the Quran, but not the Quran without the Hadith. I think probably what the intention of that statement is that so much of the Quran is interpreted by the Hadith. To know what Muhammad is the importance or the explanation of what he is saying, oftentimes Hadith give explanations as to some of the statements or some of these pronouncements of Muhammad, some of the things you find in the Quran. So the Hadith performs somewhat the service of interpretation of the Quran, of giving an idea when some of the surahs of the Quran were uttered, and what their meaning is or was for the early part of the life of the early community.
Question.
Yeah.
Would it be safe to say that these are the best commentary of the Quran?
Commentary.
See,
it's
see.
Not. It's nothing like complete. You see, that not all verses of the Quran are dealt with, but it does tend to be a commentary on some passages that it takes up. So in that sense, it is a commentary, and it's a commentary given often by the author. You know, the vehicle of the trend of the Quran. So whenever Muhammad speaks. Or one of his close friends trying to relate in some way what the Quran says to the daily life of the community, then it does become an effective interpreter. But the whole problem is that, as we've seen, that not all the Hadith are reliable, and some people made an effort to prove things from the Hadith, which began to take on a different tone from the Quran, and this raised red flags for various Muslims. The Wahhabites, the Wahhabi people, the people who reformed Islam, for example, in Saudi Arabia, had one of their slogans, "Back to the Quran." And this is being said a great deal in several Islamic countries and several communities today, that we should get back to the Quran, that the Hadith have opened doors, have led people into possibilities for straying from the essential meanings of the Quran. So there is that trend or the tendency in the Islamic community these days to take the Quran more seriously again, and to be very careful and guarded in dealing with the Hadith and using it as a resource or a source of for life and belief. One of the people I met personally who talks this way is Fazlur Rahman, a Pakistani scholar who taught at McGill for some time. He's now in the University of Chicago. He sees some of that danger and has been trying to help people to understand the Quran better. He's just written a book about the Quran. I think it's something about the meaning of the Quran or something to that effect. And he's trying to help people to understand the Quran, to understand it as it was given, you might say, sort of like we have for biblical theology, a Quran theology, to try to trace the meaning of the Quran from the earliest periods, how the system of thought develops in the Quran. And he's a little concerned about a misuse of the hadith, the traditions of Islam. So this will give you some ideas to the relative importance of these two documents as resources for Muslim life. But certainly you'll find a lot of references in Muslim writings to various traditions. Sometimes you'll find a quotation from the Quran, and then again you'll find something from Muslim or Bukhari, you know, the name of a surah of the Quran. Maybe you'll come across Baqarah, you know, and then you'll see Muslim as a sort of proof text for what they're saying. So they seem to be using the Quran and the Hadith interchangeably as resources, and this is the kind of thing that some of the more careful Muslim leaders are guarding against, ranking the Hadith, especially for theological formulations, to ranking the Quran with the Hadith. In other words, to try to guarantee that people recognize that the Hadith is a sort of second type of inspiration, that it has more to do with customary life and a tradition that was passed along for a long time from one person to another verbally before it became written. And it does not have the same kind of authority as the Quran. We were talking about resources for the law, for the Sharia. There is also another resource, and that is Qiyas. To try to help people who are living today. Now, the Quran has some remarks. For instance, this is an old illustration that's probably the simplest. The qiyas means analogical reasoning, to try to reason out from one known principle to an unknown what a person may do or should not do. Let's take the case of something that the people found in society that's not mentioned in the Quran. Let's take the case, for example, of alcohol. Is a Muslim permitted to drink whiskey? Or is that haram? Is it something forbidden? Well, there's nothing in the Quran about this, so there's no guidance there. Well, what are you going to use for a guidance then? Well, in the Quran, wine is forbidden. And wine is forbidden because it depresses a person's control center. It affects his self-control, his control of himself. And that quality is found in alcohol. So the alcohol in wine is the substance which makes it difficult for a person to have complete control of himself, and therefore he does that which is foolish and wrong and acts in an improper way. So in whiskey, that same quality of alcohol is found, and in greater proportions, perhaps in a stronger stronger dosage. So that same principle, therefore, would, by analogical reasoning, make whiskey also prohibited. Or, in fact, any alcoholic beverage. So all alcoholic beverages, then, by analogical reasoning, from what is forbidden in the Quran, should be forbidden in our life. It's not only wine, therefore, but all alcoholic beverages, because they have that same effect of dampening or putting out of effect that self-control center in us. So that's the kind of a principle it is. It's analogical reasoning. So this judges that are faced with a new situation go back into the precedents of legal decisions that were made before and try to find a similar situation or some kind of principle that will apply in the new situation. And from that, by analogical reasoning, make their decision as to whether or not a thing is acceptable or permissible or is forbidden.
So this is done just by the, like our court cases would be done today in the United States, as far as, you know, Supreme Court cases, Brown versus whoever.
Okay, yeah. But now once, you see, as in our law cases, once this judgment is made by a judge, it's written down, and that precedent then is in effect. So a judge today can say, as in the case of so-and-so versus so-and-so, that judgment was given, I therefore, in this case, also use the same judgment, and so. Having once taken place, that becomes a principle of law for all further, for other legists also, for other judges. And unless something like a Supreme Court or some mufti or qadi overthrows that and says, hey, you made a mistake, you forgot this element, that becomes now normative for the community, you see. So what happens is that the things that happen in the early period get to be the pattern of Muslim behavior and law for the future, and it gets to be written into a system and fixed rigidly. So what took place back in the days of Muhammad gets to be the norm for today's life, even in modern civilization today. What you're speaking about there is a principle of law that was also used. This is private opinion. In the early periods, the judges used a lot of this kind of private opinion and made these decisions. But then private opinion of one judge began to appear as different from that of another judge. So there were different circumstances, of course, but also different opinions. And judges from different countries, different nations, with their own different legal traditions, which led to conflicts. And so there had to be something to bring these opinions into some kind of system. And that's what they did with this principle called ijma. That's the consensus, the agreed upon practice built on the consensus. These three, I've got to be cautious with all these Arabic scholars in here. Jama'ah. That's it. Jama'ah. Means to bring together or to congregate, and has all kinds of other meanings. So here, the bringing together the consensus of the opinions of the legal authorities, not just anybody's legal opinion, but the opinion of recognized ulama, of legal experts, becomes another resource or another source of legal pronouncement. And this begins to restrict that private opinion use, because one man might differ from the other legist, but the greatest number of legal experts, once they had made up their minds, this is the way the Quran and the Hadith and the religious life and tradition of Islam sees this kind of behavior or this kind of problem. Once they had made their decision, their consensus becomes the fixed law for the rest of the society, for probably on into the future. And this cut down what's called ijtihad, which meant this kind of struggle, independent reasoning, independent judgment. They had to come to some kind of consensus, lest everybody's opinion be regarded as normative. That couldn't happen. There had to be some kind of expression of where the community was going to stand. That's kind of based on a statement that Muhammad made too. Muhammad is reported to have said that his ummah would never agree upon any evil thing upon the earth. So that once you get the opinion of all the community, then you know that this must be correct. So the consensus, the gathering together of the opinions of the experts who know what they're talking about, that forms the body of legal opinion. So qiyas and ijma were used as other resources for drawing up the legal body that's called the Holy Law of Islam or the Sharia. Now, then there's another small complication, and that is that the legal schools, in turn, were brought into, there were centers of law, let me say it that way, there were centers of law which followed the teachings of various legal experts, people that were regarded as highly authoritative, as speaking well for the whole community, but they did have small differences of opinion. There was the school of Abu Hanifa, there was the school of Malik ibn Anas, there was the school of Ash-Shafi'i, and the school of Hanbal. Now, these various schools were all recognized as speaking on behalf of the Muslim community. And what you have to do is to declare or to decide for yourself that you are going to follow in the way of the school, probably the school that has predominance in the area in which you live. For example, if you're in West Africa, you'll probably come under the school of Malik, and you will be judged by that school and its predominant type of legal opinion. You'll be judged by those laws unless you say from the beginning, and you have to stay with that, of course, that you adhere to another school of law. Now, usually this kind of thing doesn't come up with ordinary citizens because living in a certain area, generally in that area, one school is predominant. But if a person happens to be moving about or something, it might just occur. So you can see that just as we saw yesterday in the case of the text of the Quran, there are various qira'at of the Quran. There are various readings. Amongst them, the Egyptian text is becoming the most authoritative in Islamic countries, and the others are more or less being forgotten. In the matter of hadith, there are these six leaders who have drawn up books and categorized all of the narratives concerning the Prophet. And all of them are recognized as having some authority in the Muslim community, some right to exist, some right to propound their own findings. And now in legal matters also there are these varying schools. The school of the Hanifites, the school of the Malikites, the school of Shafi'ites, and the school of the Hanbalites. Hanbal is a very conservative school. I think that probably Saudi Arabia and a few other countries follow his school. Very, very strict and conservative, almost an extremist conservative type of legal school. So those schools are called madhab, schools of law. And you have to follow one of those four schools and you will be judged by the school in which your life is patterned.
Now, do the Shias follow one of those four schools, or would they concentrate on just one of them, or depending on the area where they live, or how would they fit in there?
I would Now I have to just guess. I don't know. I really don't know about that. I would imagine that they have their own legal expert also. I remember that we went to a Shiite mosque in Nairobi, and he told us at least the schools of the Hadith, they follow one, the Ismailis, I don't know if you've met them, the Ismailis follow one of these Hadith schools, and he told us also something about the legal school, but I can't give you a definite answer on that. I would imagine that they have their own legist as well. But that's an area that I have to check. I'm not sure about that. Did I see another hand? No.
Did you spell that word you used for schools?
Madhab? Madhab. No, it's one word. I just put this between here so you don't think that I've. This stands for one letter in Arabic, Dal, and this is a separate letter, Madhab. The plural is madhahib, but madhab is the singular. It's a school of law, madhab. Now, the Sharia law is founded in most Muslim countries. Muslims like to be judged according to their own laws, according to the Sharia. They have also what you might call a supreme judge. A qadi is a judge appointed usually in a Muslim state by the state authorities to administer the law in the courts. And these appointments are usually made by the ulama of a given country. The ulama, the leaders, the older people, the people that are recognized as elders, let's say, the Muslim elders of the community. A mufti can be a private individual or a state individual. His work or appointment is covered the examination of special subjects. For instance, he might deal with a thing like, abortion, for instance. Is this right or wrong? Birth control and these kind of things. To make pronouncements about these things that come up in modern life and are a test to the community and its behavior. And when they make a decision make a pronouncement, the pronouncements are usually called fatwa. Fatwa. F-A-T-W-A. I know in Nigeria a few years ago, as the state of Nigeria was ruled for a long time by military rulers, and then the military rulers wanted to return the control of the government to elected officers. And when this was taking place in Nigeria, the Muslims of that country wanted to have a Muslim Supreme Court so that their Sharia courts would all be headed up by a Supreme Court in the country. Now, to have one state and to have two legal systems and even two Supreme Courts seemed to most of the citizens of Nigeria to be contradictory, that this would make for impossible civil rule. And so there was a lot of dispute for a long time about this, and certain Christians stood strong on this. And finally, the Muslims withdrew their adamant demand to have their own Muslim Supreme Court. And so the new state of Nigeria has been erected with one Supreme Court that applies to all the citizens, and the Muslims are permitted, of course, to be judged by their own courts, their own Sharia courts. And that gives you a feeling for the thing that happens in Islam. Whenever Islam is a minority group, whenever the Muslims are a minority in a country, there always will be that pressure towards having their own state expression, to have their own rule, their own government, and to have their own courts. So Islam wants to be a total community, and Muslims feel somehow like orphans if they don't have all of the expression of their Islamic life right up to government and the courts. Muslims find it hard to accept a secular state which is willing to give a right to various opinions to people of differing faiths. They feel that their whole life should be governed by Islam and should be ruled the behavior of the life of Muslims should be ruled by their own courts. And not to have that makes them feel somehow incomplete. Try to understand that. It is a threat, of course, because like in Nigeria, in the early years of the Federation, when Nigeria became independent, the whole country was happy and joyful receiving their independence, and everyone was grateful for the kind of government that was set up. But very soon after the nation had its beginning, its rise, there was this drive on the part of Muslims to make Nigeria a Muslim state. That drive became so strong that finally, this is only one of the issues, but it certainly was one of the major ones, there was this coup that put out of effect the Muslim head of government of the Federation, and one of the prime ministers also was assassinated. But that drive for a Muslim state by Muslim people is almost natural. So try to understand it if you happen to be in a situation where that kind of thing comes up, but also be aware of the dangers.
Question, isn't there a pressure in Europe for teaching in the public schools there of Islam? I think I read that somewhere.
To have their own schools?
Well, but at least a religious education within the, maybe it was England, I don't know, wonder if anyone's read of it.
Well, I know this kind of situation exists in England, or at least in England, English protectorates. You have a part of the curriculum is given to each person's religion to give him an opportunity for release time for religious education. Now, generally, of course, that in England that would be for most of the Anglican and Presbyterian, maybe a few of the Church of Methodists and so on, to have an opportunity to come and to take care of the religious education of their children. They wanted to be part of the educational life of the students. So it may be that Muslims are saying, well, now in this release time, we want to have the opportunity to teach our children in that time. Is that possibly what you're referring to?
Part of the curriculum itself, I don't know. It's so hazy tonight.
We had this in Nigeria too, and Kenya. There's this release time for religious education, and every religious group had the opportunity to come to the school at that time to have a person who was knowledgeable, was able, sort of a licensed person recognized by the church, or a religious group, to teach the children of their group that are attending that school. They had an opportunity then to carry on their religious education. So Muslims were also trying to take advantage of that, of course. And there is sometimes an effort to keep out other bodies, you know, for one person, one group to assume the teaching for all of the religious groups, whether that be, you know, one of the Christian bodies or Islamic body, and so more or less usurp the whole job of religious education from one particular religious point of view, and that's where there are often disputes. For instance, if you had, let's just say, you have the Jehovah's Witnesses have a group there, the Assemblies of God have a group, the Baptists have a group, Anglicans have a group, Muslims have a group. Now suppose the Anglicans say, we'll send a priest here to take care of the religious instruction for all of these groups, or for all of the, let's say, Protestant groups. And then if there's some other body like the Muslims, they would have their own. Then this one group would tend to dominate the teaching that's given in that period. So maybe Muslims are claiming a right to teach their children, and maybe this is being disputed by British for some reason or other. I wonder if that may be the problem. They're afraid because the teacher is often given a salary too, some stipend for doing that thing. So the state government pays for the religious education given in the schools. And maybe the Christian people don't like to pay a salary to a Muslim teacher to do that. That may be a possibility.
So it's a law in Pakistan that all Muslims have to be taught by a Muslim, someone trained in Muslim theology.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the law. So even Muslim children studying in Christian schools have to have that. Of course, most of the schools have been nationalized now.
Another thing that's happened, I know this happened in Kenya once or twice, the school figures, you know, some of the people that come in to do that teaching don't appear to be very capable in the way of teaching young folks, and the children tend not to give as much honor as they should to some of the leaders that came in to do that instruction. So the schools felt that this period was being wasted, really, wasn't being used well, and they thought it would be better for the education department of government to set up various curricula, and to have somebody in the school, some teacher who's qualified to teach people, to teach these courses. So then you get somebody who's not necessarily committed by faith or religious commitment to any one given religion, teaching these children some faith or other. Just as we're trying to talk about Islam here, and maybe probably Muslims would say, I'm not qualified at all to teach other people about Islam. That kind of thing, you see, that might be another problem that the British are having trouble with. In other words, for the educators of the country to take over that right on behalf of the religious bodies.
I'm not sure I understand the distinction between the Mufti and the Qadi. Now, would the pronouncements made by the Mufti be guidelines of the Qadi in making their decisions in particular cases, or is...
Yeah, Qadi is usually someone appointed by the state. Now, Mufti may be a person in his own right, but he's a person of high caliber whose words are recognized to have a considerable weight. And often when he makes a statement, it is recognized as being rather so formidable that it becomes almost illegal, like a papal bull, for example. Whereas a Qadi would be a lower, on a lower level, but a state-appointed judge. I don't know how, I'm not up enough on American law to know just where to put him. The Mufti might be one of these federal judges, you know, spread all over the country. Or he might be one of the Supreme Court judges. Maybe the president of the Supreme Court or something like that. And a Qadi might be the lower type of federal thing. Well, I don't really feel like I'm in a strong enough position to talk about Islam in modern situation with all of you who are coming from Pakistan just so recently and from Jordan and what have you, from Afghanistan. And but maybe we could share in this, and if you have opinions, I'd like to have you express them. Let's talk about a little bit about Islam in the modern situation. There was a statement made by, I believe it's by Wilfred Cantwell Smith, that Islam is sort of running out of steam as militarily, politically, commercially, and he, I think, even said intellectually or inferred that, and religiously. During the 18th and first part of the 18th and 19th century, Islam began to decline in all of these directions. While in European situation, there was a sort of revitalization. And Muslims felt that too. They felt there was a discrepancy between the Muslim community, which is the Dar al-Islam. Maybe we make too much of this division, but I've heard Muslims make that same division to try to give us foreigners a little understanding about the Islam too. The world is divided into two categories. I'm sorry, this world isn't round. It's a little bit elliptical. Dar al-Islam. And if I make a mistranscription, you Arabs, Arabic scholars, please tell me. Like somebody told me yesterday, quite correctly, I shouldn't have had an H on here. This is Ummah. There should have not have been an H. And the Dar al-Harb. I'm not certain of, I'm just doubting that one now, if that should have a G, Dar al-Harb, I believe. The world, the community, the place of Islam, the place where Islam is dominant, the place where God's will, as it's been made known through Muhammad, is being observed, where people are committing themselves to God along the lines of that kind of commitment, and the place where Islam is engaged in conflict, is still trying to bring people, to invite people into the Dar al-Islam, but is still not complete, that process is not finished. That's the place where the struggle is still going on, and the kingdom of God will have come, finally, when all of this is Dar al-Islam. If there is a kingdom concept in Islam, it's probably something like that. Now, in this Dar al-Islam, one would expect, you see, when a whole people have committed themselves to God and to obeying God as he has made himself known through his messenger, through his Rasul, that God's will would be done, that there would be something permanent, that there would be something invincible, something progressing, developing in light and goodness and so on in that area. But when Muslims took a good look during the last part of the 18th century and through the 19th century, they began to see all kinds of cracks and signs of degeneration that made this whole thing look incorrect. That Dar al-Islam was not living up to its calling, to its status. Whereas in the Dar al-Harb, there was revitalization, there was progress, militarily, politically, economically, discoveries were being made, a lot, education was going ahead at a pace. So, what's wrong? And then when militarily, Muslims lost control of their own governments when the Turks were defeated. Again, when the Turks defeated the Saudi Arabian government, Saudi Arabia, and then later when the Turks were defeated, and their military power was gone, and the West was actually controlling, was acting as protector of the lands and the governments of Islamic countries again. That seemed to be all. That seemed to be sort of a last straw. What's gone wrong? And people began to make inquiries as to what has happened and how can we get back on the trail again. There were all kinds of opinions offered and different theories given. A man by the name of Jamal al-Din Afghani was a champion of pan-Islamism. And he said, let's get all of the Muslim states together in one great Islamic empire. Let's forget all the things that divide us. And let's join forces and combine all our efforts and seek this revitalization. So he was sort of following along the line of some kind of political force, getting this Darul Islam to become one political unit and so to achieve some of this. Another man by the name of Muhammad Abdu, an Egyptian, said, no, we need to get, we have to make an accommodation between Islam and the modern age. We cannot go on living as though we're still in the days of Muhammad in the year 622 AD. We are now in the 19th century. And he thought that it would be through the reform of the whole Islamic system that an evolution of a new Islam would have to come about. And he thought that a way to bring this about would be through education as a major means. And he wanted to introduce various new curricula into the Al-Azhar University to teach Muslim students more about the world in which they live, more about science, and help them to get a view of the modern world so that they could cope in a much more thorough way with what was going on. The same kind of advice was given probably by Syed Ahmed Khan, who believed that Indian Muslims would have to incorporate studies of sciences in Aligarh University. Science and religion would have to work together for the renewal of the people and to bring people up to date. There were all kinds of polemical attacks in those days against the Christian world, but this was probably raised by the work of missionaries. In those days, in the 18th century, in the early part of the 19th century especially, missionary methods seemed to have a lot to do with apologetic and polemic. And this infuriated Muslims and made them also become very critical of Christianity and go back into history and even to examine scriptures and so on to try to find ways to combat the attacks of missionaries. So the critique that the Christian body brought against Islam was not taken as seriously and was not as helpful as it could have been. There was a notion that Islam had to be purified from the corrupting influences and practices that had been going on for some time. Islam was not living up to its ideals, its judges, its ulama, its rulers were not living up to the principles of Islam, and this had to be revised and renewed. Reformation, as we've already seen, of Muslim higher education had to be undertaken. Reformulation of Islamic doctrine in the light of modern thought had to be engaged in. This was one of the teachings of Iqbal, an Indian Muslim of some repute. He wrote a book called Reconstruction of Religious Thoughts in Islam. A man by the name of Faizi talked about the modernization of Islam also. then defense of Islam against European influences and against Christian attacks was another effort that was undertaken. People felt that while they did have to engage in work against animism and materialism in their countries, they should not be subject to the attacks of Christians. And so a lot of effort was made to defend Islam against European influences, against influences which were regarded to be decadent and immoral and therefore improper and un-Islamic, and also the attacks of Christians against the religious system of Islam. So there was a lot of effort that was engaged in order to help Muslims to realize that they had slipped back and had lost ground and had to engage in great effort to try to be brought back to their status in the world. Some of that probably happened when Napoleon invaded Egypt. That's when it became apparent in the 1800s. Then, as I said, the defeat of Arabia by the Turks, and later the defeat of the Turks by the Allies. This whole thing came to the foreground, and people were made aware that they had slipped. For so long, Islam had ascendancy in medicine and in military affairs and in control of a vast amount of the world's turf. And something had to be done to get Islam back on the trail. So we find a lot of statements today. There's a revitalization effort going on in many places. As I already said, some people are saying the reason Islam has come into its present state of malaise is that we have forsaken the ways of God. We're no longer adhering to his teaching. And some people said this is due to the influence of the Sufis, the mystics. The Sufi teachings, which were to the effect that we must get out of our physical entanglements and get close to God. The whole effort is a mystical effort to get near to God, to be lost in the divine. And this mystical effort tended to get people to be rather careless about their life and their behavior, their attention to the ceremonial regulations of Islam. They no longer kept the fast as they should. They no longer prayed as often as they should. They weren't as busy with Quranic studies as they might have been. They got lost in this whole process of trying to free themselves of the entanglements of the flesh and of things that would keep them away from God, and got lost in this pursuit of person-to-person involvement with God. And this movement came under attack even when it started many centuries ago for that same reason. And now today it's coming under attack again. Also because Sufis tend to revere very highly leaders of very Sufi movements and tend to feel that there's some kind of barakah, some kind of blessing that these leaders have. That you can go to a tomb of one of these ancient Sufi leaders, and if you have an incurable cancer, or if you have some kind of major problem, if a woman wants a child, or a man wants a wife, or something, you go to this tomb and touch it and pray. Or, you know, this feeling of wanting the power of the divine somehow to be transmitted to you through some earthly remains of some great person of God. So that there tends to be this drifting away into all of these pursuits which are really un-Islamic, and a lack of attention to the way of life that God taught through Muhammad, the way of ceremonial obedience and the way of obeying the Sharia of Islam. So people blamed Sufism, they blamed their worldliness, they blamed their following in Western ways sometimes. People today are blaming, for example, let me go back just a little ways. In order to get caught up with today's world, there were some national leaders like Ataturk in Turkey and Nasser in Egypt and the family of the Shah in Iran. These leaders all believed that it would be better for them to press towards a more secularized type state in order to allow more freedom for people and to allow people who are religious to carry on their religious life faithfully and obediently with piety, but to press on, to have more education in the country, to be able to adapt some of the Western style, you know, educational systems, to get more industrialization into their countries. And so they tried to get some of the tight-fisted religious control of their country relaxed a little bit so that people would have more chance to follow in secular pursuits and so bring a little more of the breeze of technology and so on, Western technological society into their countries to bring them up to date technologically and scientifically. Now, a lot of that has been done. Turkey was secularized. Islam, of course, remained the religion of that state, but religion could be carried on not only in the Arabic language, but Islam could be carried on in the Turkish language. The Adhan was no longer, in the days of Ataturk, no longer called out in Arabic. It was called out in the Turkish language. These little Quranic schools were abolished, where children were only taught to read and to write the Quran and to develop in Quranic skills and the ways of the Hadith and the laws and so on, and weren't given much of an education beyond that. Those schools were abolished, and a curriculum such as the Western schools had with reading and writing and, you know, geography and all of these other subjects were brought in. And those kind of developments took place in Turkey, but the religious life was still that of Islam. Islam remained the dominant religion of Turkey. But other forces were admitted into the country. And as you know, the Shah, recently deceased Shah and his father pursued a course of industrialization and secularization with great gusto, to such an extent that the country wasn't able to keep up with the pace of it. That's probably one of the reasons for the revolution that took place. And they were too strong in trying to overthrow the power of the religious vested powers in Iran. Now, this, Muslims are saying, this isn't helping us today. Muslims are saying, this is part of the kind of thing that the Sufis are doing. This is the kind of thing that is going to drag us further and further away from God and His blessing. You can't call Egypt today and Turkey and Iran today Dar al-Islam if secularism is allowed to have this much scope. If we see people walking on the streets in this way and behaving this way so freely, and we see theaters with all their lurid things and literature and all that kind of thing, this decadence of the West coming in, and the Western type education and TV and what have you, all of this is corrupting our people, and it's leading to God's punishment upon us, and we're being dragged away further and further from Dar al-Islam. So now there is this kind of reaction against this whole thing, against this type of influence of secularization, secularizing of their countries, and there are these revolutionary movements which are becoming more and more popular.
So they have an equivalent to Jerry Falwell then.
And besides, should I make a comment? Besides all this, today there are the influences of the power states with all of the political implications. Russia is playing its role in Afghanistan, in Iran, Iraq and Syria, Libya. Libya, again, the president of Libya would like very much to be the head of a pan-Islamic movement and doing his best to call back people to the Quran, and in the same time is flirting with materialistic and atheistic Russia. How he can square all that, I don't know. But anyway, he's making an effort. So he's trying to have the best of two worlds, I guess, to get a hold of the bomb, so he'll be up to par on that one, and still say that the world of Islam must be ruled by the Quran. He's talking a little bit like that too, back to the Quran, and to the simple life of the primitive community of Islam, which would be normative for us today. He wants to make that the normative life of Islam. Yeah.
How much influence, my perception of what's happening, also another aspect of battling against the Sufis and battling against secularism, is the strength of Islam. The thing I see them using a lot also is the driving against the common enemy, calling all the forces to battle against Israel and the occupation there. It's particularly important in just the immediate area, Lebanon and Jordan, Syria, Egypt, where all those countries have been just so severely disrupted, all their economic life, their political life, just in the influx of these hundreds of thousands, in Lebanon's case, a couple million, influx of Palestinians. There are very real, practical problems involved in just absorbing these kind of refugees. They have very real and obvious needs to solve the problem. And a lot of the calling on the Islamic Brotherhood to get together and to solve the problem, whether it's by driving the enemy into the sea or whatever. There's a lot of talk that way.
Now, you people who have been close to that, do you think that that is... I know everybody talks that way. How many people really are really ready to take up the gun and do something about it, do you think?
Well, the Gaddafi is ready any time.
Yeah, he talks that way.
He is. The others.
You see, Egypt has, the way I observe it and the way Egyptians talked about when I was in Egypt, Egypt has had to take the major brunt of that whole struggle. And it's Egyptians that are being killed. It's Egyptian wealth that's being destroyed. It's Egypt that's taking the bombs and whatnot and facing the Israelis. Oh, here and there, there's a little struggle, with the Syrians and so on. And Jordan maybe enters in a little wedge and pulls away again. But Egypt had to take the brunt of that. As long as they could do it, they did. But it's not possible for them to do everything they have to do today, so they're backing away. I'm just wondering how much that's really, is it lip service to the Arab cause?
See, like Jordan is 70% Palestinian. Maybe more, we're not sure who it is.
But what happened to Palestinians in Jordan?
They had a civil war. They tried to have a civil war. They had a civil war in 71. And they were successfully put down that time. The PLO was
and fairly well driven out, weren't they?
The PLO was, yes.
Yeah.
The PLO leaders were driven out. But, if they enter into a war with 70% of the population wanting their homeland back, and they've got a big chunk of the land that internationally is still recognized part of Jordan. They can't help but go into the war.
Mm-hmm.
They can stab with skirmishes, which, if you want to read about the King of Jordan, the government there is an excellent article on Reader's Digest this month on the King. But all I was asking about is how much of an effect, that they're trying to call the countries back to Islam, for the, let's forget about all these little problems. let's concentrate on the enemy and form our brotherhood that way. And if we can unite together, we can drive out the enemy, and then after the enemy is driven out, we can stay united. I'm just curious how much of an effect you saw there.
I would say that this would have an effect. Now, Egypt is saying we don't want to be, count us out for now. We just can't stand, you know, we just can't get into this involvement of human loss and economic loss and whatnot, all that it's involved in it, leave us alone for a while. So Egypt is counting itself out. Libya is still in, as you say.
Although Egypt wanted, there's a bunch of oil wells that they got back in the whole deal, though. So they had some very practical games to make out of science.
All right, but you can't isolate these. There are always all kinds of involvements, aren't there? But these countries, I would admit that they are still very much involved. Now you get to Iraq, I don't know how much they're really willing to be committed and involved. And now Persia and Turkey.
No, but Saudi is ready to fund.
You see, as soon as you get out of this basin area, it's no longer a driving issue. It's still a talking issue, but it is it really a matter of regarding Israel as a common enemy? So
not then outside it, of the area.
Yeah. So that's one point to think about. And there, I would say, I feel with them that this is an injustice. I don't know how we can square that with any, you know, it is an injustice. And we should all be involved in trying to work out something that guarantees Palestinians some, you know, some place under the sun, just as much as we're worried about the Jews to have a place under the sun. They're scattered all over. The Jews, there are more Jews in this country than in Palestine. For many of our friends and our Christian friends now, this whole thing has become a, you know, a sort of prophetic involvement with the end times involvement and so on. But I don't know if you can consider the present Israeli state as really what's involved in Scripture. So that it's definitely one of the things that's playing a big role today, and it should be all over the world, really, until this thing is amicably settled and that we can have some kind of peace in that area. And the involvement, you know, in that, of the United States with Israel, Russia with Syria and Iraq and Libya and so on, that this keeps that whole area just boiling. And it does involve Islam, certainly. There are a lot of cries and calls that put that at the center of Islamic concentration at the present time. What kind of influence the rest of you feel going on in your observation? Now in Pakistan, there's been this effort to make Pakistan an expression of a true Islamic state. What are people saying about that? Is it coming off, or are people unhappy? What are they saying about that?
Well, the present General Zia-ul-Haq is an army general and a very pious Muslim. I think sincerely wants to see an Islamic state. They have several moves in that direction. They have, I can't understand it all, but they have this, regard to Sharia, they have, along with the Supreme Court, they have this this Islamic, these Islamic judges that make sure the laws are in conformity with Islamic law. So they do have this regular civil law carried over from the British. But I think there's a movement to gradually get away from that and go to strict Islamic law. But it seems to me that there's tension. I was talking to a man who's a political leader and met him at the airport, and that was when there was a movement of about 8 or 9 political parties came out urging General Zia to have elections and to really putting on the pressure to to cut out censorship and news censorship and all that. And this political leader, actually, he was pretty high up in a certain political party. He said something should be done. He said Pakistan's ripe for communism if nothing is done soon, because you've got the secular influence, and then you've got the very strict religious, and the common man is not that strict a Muslim. So you've got these forces seemingly against each other. So I don't know what's going to happen. But boy, they certainly are anti-Israel. I mean, the newspapers are just, and they're solidly with the Muslim bloc.
Let's get an office set up now in Pakistan to sign up people that would fight, don't they?
Yeah, and
are they taking in tens or hundreds or thousands of people
really
to fly
don't.
Over and help fight?
I don't know about that. They had the time of the festivals, like the Bakr Eid, they collect the skins to raise money for the Palestinian cause. I chatted with some of them once and tried to get their point of view. I have to be careful, though. I didn't want to go wrong.
Yeah, we can't even talk about that. If somebody asks you what you think about such and such, you just say, well, just not very informed there. We can't talk about it. It's that sensitive an issue in Jordan.
But these things that happened a number of years ago when, it was a second war between Egypt and Israel. When was that? I can't remember. But these things affect the Christian community. Our little correspondence school, we had our first course has quite a bit to deal with the history of Israel, of course, the Old Testament passages. And I got a letter to the Jewish principal, Pakistan Bible Correspondence School. Very angry letter, signed by about 12 students, saying that you are supporters of Zionists. And of course the Christians of Pakistan are very, very pro-Israel.
Really?
Oh yeah.
Why?
Well, it's prophecy, you know. And they're a minority. When you're a minority, you tend to be against the majority position, even though that may be right.
That's interesting. Yeah. Are the Christians in Pakistan primarily pre-millennial?
Well, I don't know if they know their Bibles yet.
Are the missionaries that have taught them Bibles?
See, one thing too, I mean, Begin's associated, you know, Israel's fight also with the protection of the Christians in southern Lebanon, which is...
That's just to keep the...
That's exactly right.
The pot boiling.
Right, not only that, but if you can keep the Christians fighting the Palestinians, I mean, it keeps them a little bit bigger.
Just not... Whoa. A lot of Palestinians are Christians.
Right, but there's not different, though. Yeah, I will agree with you there. All of my Palestinian friends are Christians. At the same time, if you can there is still a difference between, let's say, your Lebanese Maronite Christians and your Falangists and your Palestinian Christians. And even those two don't get along all that well. And it's especially as far as PR in the United States and other places, if you can get Americans and Christians in other countries to believe that Israel is not only out to the Zionist state, but also out to the protection of Christians within that area. I mean, he's got just that much more PR going for him. So, I mean, if he can make it, just like the Muslims, if you can make anything a Shiite, if you can make it a holy one, my God, you're all better off. And you've got him marching into it.
Any other comments about the modern situation, that your observation as to what directions, any predictions you want to make about directions that are underway? Again?
The revolution that Iran went under, do you see many other states about to under that kind of revolution where...
Well, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood coming back into Egypt, when I was there 2 years ago, well, previous to that, the women had all been in Western street clothes. Now in Egypt, you'll find many of the women back in their old Muslim dress with the black hoods and the black garments. And Muslim Brotherhood literature out prominently displayed, and the Muslim Brotherhood spokesmen having their say again in Egypt, whereas they were put down by Nasser.
Yeah, you may introduce the Muslim Brotherhood to the people in class who don't know about how much success they've had.
Would you like to do that?
Right.
The Muslim Brotherhood, I think, could be said to be an effort to, for example, in Egypt, to speak against Nasser's efforts to secularize. It's a conservative group that are trying to talk also about the evils of decadence of the West, and talking about going back to the pure Islam, and speaking against secularization. Promoting the old values of Islam. And during the days of Nasser, they became very strong in Egypt, and even I think probably were found to be behind attempts to assassinate the ruler. And so they were put down and made an illegal body in Egypt. They operate in other countries in the Middle East also, Ikhwan al-Muslimin. But they have been underground for a little while, but now they're coming out and speaking boldly again, and Sadat is not trying to squash them. He's allowing them to speak again, possibly because he's trying to allow a little room too for the Christian church in his country. Sadat is an amazing person. He's trying to keep the doors open for people to give expression to their religious faith, and yet trying to be a faithful, loyal Muslim at the same time, to give people a chance to speak, but not to become revolutionary, to try to overthrow the state and so on. So he's walking a tightrope all the time, and there's a lot of tension. As you know, Egypt is having a hard time providing the wherewithal for its citizens to live. Existence is a problem for hundreds of thousands in Egypt today, as it is in many Muslim countries. And Sadat is doing his very best to be a moderate ruler in those circumstances, and I really think highly of him. And Numairi is trying to do the same in the Sudan. We don't hear much about the Sudan anymore, but there used to be a civil war between the black people and the Arabs in the Sudan, and this came to be largely regarded as a war of the Arabs against Christians and pagans. Now that's been brought to reconciliation largely by efforts of the Christian church, and Numairi is trying to keep that balance, and he's having a hard time because the majority of the people are Muslims, and that's where the power is. So both of these rulers are engaged in that process because they have major Christian minorities living amongst them, and other minorities of size.
What do you think is going to happen in Iran?
Oh, I wouldn't. If things continue now, I would say the future for communism there seems pretty good. Ikhwan al-Muslimin, Ikhwan al-Muslimin, Brotherhood of Muslims. So they have a lot of power in that far east. It's a strident voice for conservative Islam and for conserving conservative Islam, you know, preserving it.
And anti-anything but Islam, not just
right.
Pushing Islam.
Including Christianity, yeah. Well, now we've been talking so far all about Islam to try to get a little bit of an impression of Islam we haven't talked about the faith of Muslims much, but we're struggling with time here, and I'd like to reserve that for talking about specific issues that we will address as Christians in our witness. So we've been talking more or less about how Islam came into being, its resources for faith and for life in the Quran and Hadith and the legal systems and so on. Now this afternoon we want to, if we have a chance, I would like to see this film strip showing a sort of a brief wrapping up of all of this to give you an idea of Islam as it is. And then I'd like to start on how we could and should confront Islam with the gospel of Jesus Christ. So we'll be entering into a new area of discussion and new topics in the afternoon.